This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Next week, we're going to dive back into the World War II generation, but today we're hearing from a Purple Heart recipient from the Korean War, John Smetana of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Later on in life, he would work on nose cones for the space shuttle project, but in 1953, he found himself in some of the fiercest and bloodiest fighting of the entire Korean War. A Navy corpsman, his job was to treat the wounded among the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division in combat like the infamous Battle for Outpost Vegas along the main line of resistance at the end of March in 1953. John, I imagine probably then more than ever, you had to be prepared to deal with men whose wounds you could do very little for, that you felt you couldn't do enough for, those brave Marines whose families would become Gold Star families.
One thing about it, you never got real personal with the other people. I mean, you knew who they were, but you didn't get that feeling like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? You try to do the best you can, try to save as many as you can, and you knew you're going to lose some in that kind of a battle, but you did what you could, and you just asked God to take care of them and watch over them. That's all you could do.
And when you described that fight for Outpost Vegas, losing it, regaining it, guys killed, guys captured, were you afraid you were going to get killed in that situation?
Yeah, you were crazy if you didn't think you could get it, because there was stuff flying all over the place, shrapnel and everything, and you have to expect it. And being a corpsman, there was a lot of times you didn't have time to even think about it. You just taking care of guys getting hurt, getting wounded, and doing the best you could to get them back. And they were very good. They were very watchful over us, and I had plenty of good gear and did what we could and got them back for medical help if they needed more. And that happened quite a bit.
Yeah, and can you give us a sense, maybe a few examples without getting too gruesome, of the nature of the injuries you were able to treat, or how you even decided, can we help this guy or not, and move on to the guy who you can help?
I guess what I'd have to say there is, you know that if you get hit in the chest or near the lungs, you have a terrible time breathing. And all you can do out there in the field is put compression wounds onto bandages and hope to fill the gap so they can breathe, at least breathe, and get them back as soon as you can with the chiggy bears and on their stretchers and get a helicopter to pick them up. But most of the guys that were hit with shrapnel in other areas, like their arms, legs, lower body, you could put on bandages and tie them up real good and put them down together with some other guys and then call in the help to come and get them out at like a train, like a stretcher train. And I've seen them 15, 20 deep where they were lined up waiting to go back. Yeah, you couldn't really help some of them. Some of them had to either make it or not make it, and that was up to the wound. But you can only do so much. In other words, you couldn't give them plasma out there in the field. You couldn't do things like you can in the hospital, except for the shrapnel wounds that you could see and know where they were. But if a guy was hit hard and critical, you did what you could, made sure that you filled out their emergency tags, and if you gave them morphine and what time and all that kind of thing. But you knew that you were going to lose some and you're going to save some. And so you just had to balance it out and try to save more than you lost.
Clearly, you were always rendering medical aid. But did you ever feel the need to try to deliver some emotional or mental or psychological aid or comfort to these guys whose bodies have just been torn up?
Yeah, being a medic, we did a lot of talking to the guys and kept their spirits up. But of course, they're taught that in the Marine Corps, in boot camp, in their training, that they knew what they were getting into and what to expect. And of course, when it happens, it's kind of a different story. But yes, I talked to quite a few of them, and a few of them I became very close to. I was saying before, I had still, after all these years, which is coming up 65, I've got 3 or 4 guys that I still write every year and send Christmas cards and talk about all the stuff we used to go through. And fortunately, they're okay now. I've lost quite a few friends that I knew for a while and felt sorry for them and their families. And that's about all you could do.
Those are guys that you treated in the field?
Yes, there's two or three that I treated, and there's quite a few fellow corpsmen that have become like professional people, captains in the state police, all kinds of things like that. One of my friends did that. Another friend played some baseball. He's in New York now. But yeah, we write every year, talk to one another. But the only Marines, there's about three of them, and two are from New York. One is from Milwaukee, and one from Flint, Michigan that I keep in touch with. And they have families, and thank goodness they're alive. We thank each other for taking care of ourselves, and I couldn't rely on a better bunch of guys.
Well, and I think we can all hear that in your comments, the respect you have for these Marines who you were with on a daily basis there in Korea. It's evident that you see them as collectively as a courageous group, a selfless group, a brave group. But do you have a story, maybe even more than one, that you think exemplifies or personifies that Marine spirit that you saw displayed over there?
Quite a few of them. This one friend of mine that became a friend was hit rather hard. He became what was known as a flamethrower person. He would do anything with the Marines. Fortunately, I got to talk to some of his family. He passed away. He was wounded over there, and he was burned rather badly. And all I could do for him at that time was give him a shot of morphine and console him, get him on a stretcher, and get him back to the lines. Well, in the meantime, after the war, I met his younger brother and got to be real good friends with him over the phone and talked to him, and it made the family feel better that I took care of him, did all we could, and God rest his soul, he passed away. But I'm still friends with his younger brother, and he's a very nice guy. He's got a family now, and of course the whole family missed the other gentleman, but they're super guys.
How many years later was that you met the brother?
Almost 45 years.
45 years after the war. Had you thought about this gentleman over those years?
Not really, no. But when I found out where he was and where he lived and started writing each other, it was very nice. And one of the other gentlemen that was here where I live now, who was a Marine, and I met him, and he was a forward artillery observer. And when he found out that I was a medic and I told him I was in Korea, him and I were on the very same outpost that got shelled and hit Vegas. And he was a forward artillery observer. He was one of the last guys to come off the hill.
Right, so you guys make that connection here. He introduces you to this other person whose brother died in Korea, but was a guy you tried to save. And you got to provide the family details they never had before about what happened to him?
I got details to tell his brother. I never told mom and dad. I left it up to the brother to do that. But to our identification purposes, the father had to do that, and he did recognize the person as to being his son. But it was just nice to receive congratulations or a job well done from a member of the family, and knowing that I was with that guy that day when he got hit so badly. Then I found out, of course, he died 3 days later on a hospital ship. Right there in Incheon. So I just felt kind of close to him that I got to meet his younger brother and talk to the family.
Yeah, you had the privilege of giving them something no one else could have given them, but it sounds like, too, that you look back on him and say, that was one brave Marine? Or how would you remember him?
Well, not only one brave Marine, he had never been in that position before and had never had that type of a job to do, but he did it. And so you know that when they're called to do something, they're going to do it. They're going to do the best they can. And you feel very secure in with a bunch of Marines, that's for sure. And it made me proud that I could help them as much as I could. And they appreciated it. And I appreciated them taking care of me.
Well, and that's one of more than 52,000 Americans who were killed during the Korean War. There many missing and still missing have never been found over there. And when you were talking about Outpost Vegas, another thing that struck me, you mentioned the Marines who got killed. You mentioned 19 more of them were captured. Did you ever consider the possibility that you might be captured, that you might become a prisoner of war?
Yes. In fact, that very day that they were captured, my friend, another corpsman, was on the outpost at that time, and he was captured. And I thought he was killed because we didn't hear anything about him. I found out many years later that he became a doctor, a pediatrician down in Florida. And so he wrote a story about the outpost when they got hit. And then I wrote my story starting with the second day after he was captured. And anyway, any of us corpsmen could have been there, could have been captured. Yeah, I thought about it because the stories that this one gentleman told in his book, they weren't too nice to any of our prisoners. I guess I can't go into anything farther, but they had some medical treatment, but it was pretty rough. And for 19 of them to get captured, and a lot of them got repatriated, and a lot of them passed away also.
Well, that's what I was getting at. And feel free to share anything. Don't hold back, but... The reason I thought about you being a prisoner and what that would mean, there was no guarantee you'd survive as a prisoner. They were mistreated badly. I've talked to guys who were beaten badly by their Korean captors or Chinese captors, had very little to eat. Talked to guys who were prisoners there who were picking the digested corn out of horse excrement to try to have something to eat. I mean, can you imagine what it would have been like to be a prisoner there?
I can imagine it, but I sure am glad I wasn't one. This one gentleman that survived came back and lived here for a while where I am, and he passed away from other things. But yes, he told stories of a lot of the guys not having any treatment, almost freezing to death, treated very badly, no food, very ill, and they actually just suffered and died. I'm glad I never got captured. I don't know what I would have done except fight to live. But I'm glad I didn't.
Well, and I know you have a fight to live, and we'll talk some more about that. But you said something there, too, the freezing conditions that prisoners had to endure. Well, if you're there for almost 2 years, you had to go through those winters and the summers and probably had extremes on both ends.
Yes, I can remember one winter. The very first winter was minus 26 degrees on quite a few mornings. We had a lot of rain. A lot of snow, pretty miserable, a lot of sleet, and in the summer, pretty hot, and we had to keep the trenches clean, drained. The trenches could get as deep as they were, like 40 inches, 48 inches, and they had to try to drain them off so we could dry them out. And of course, we all lived in those hooches and stuff. They were warm, but they weren't very comfortable, but at least we had a ceiling over our head.
And as a corpsman, you're treating wounds from bullets and bombs and artillery and grenades, but you're also probably treating results of those elements. Did you have to try to help guys who had frozen fingers, frozen feet, frozen limbs?
One of my favorite things was take your socks off at night and put them under your pillow and try to dry them out. You probably heard about it. Our first couple of winters there, we had the wrong kind of boots. They were called thermal boots. But they would sweat. Your feet would sweat inside, and then they could freeze with the temperature. And, of course, they changed that rather rapidly. They got the right kind of boots, and they were well. But I always had the guys get their socks off, keep their feet dry as much as possible, and that helped out an awful lot.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with over there, the biggest challenge you faced?
I think the biggest challenge would be keep your cool. Survive, do all the things you've learned to do, be very good friends with your fellow Marines, your fellow partners, and let them know you're there to help them, and they're there to keep you alive, which they really did a good job, because they didn't want to lose their medical technicians, and they were great fighters, and I respected everything they did, and I appreciated everything they did.
And we know that feeling was mutual, and we sure appreciate John Smetana telling us his Korean War story today. You'll find photos of John then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear more from his colorful life when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.